Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name's Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of February 28th, 2023. Today, the global carbon dioxide level is 421.62 parts per million, which is well above the 350 parts per million science tells us is safe. On top of that, there's only 2,498 days left until the year 2030, by which time we must cut our carbon emissions in half. So the clock's ticking. Got to get going. Anyway, dear listener, you have probably noticed over the last decade or so that the political discussions and the political machinery and the American process of making decisions has basically gone astray. You probably notice it when you're screaming at your TV on different nights with different people on the TV, right? Things are not have just broken down in many contexts, not just the climate context, where you will see ads from ExxonMobil telling you how green they are, stuff like that. Anyway, the political process of making decisions in our country has gotten worse and worse. And you can imagine all sorts of reasons why that is. I mean, one, reasons, you know, root causes aside, the fact is that people stop listening to each other often enough. People on either side of the aisle, myself included, reach a point where I don't want to hear Sean Hannity anymore. Right, I'm done with Sean Hannity. And so, how do you? But the flip side is, as Americans, as a democracy, as a country that wants to survive into the next century, we need to find ways to thoughtfully and meaningfully and authentically converse with each other as Americans. Right. So there's a big conundrum there, and you can see there's a huge problem. Well, problems are always in search of a solution. And so we are fortunate today to have with us an author who has written a new book coming out in late March that has to do with techniques for essentially bridging the divide, meeting people that you disagree with, and coming to some sort of meaningful understanding or some sort of resolution of things that you're worried about, you know, whatever brings you together with other people. And that that's an interesting topic for many, I mean, from the point of view of the American democracy, but also particularly from a climate perspective, because God knows in the climate perspective, there's a lot of conflicting areas of conflict that need to be resolved. So there you go. Our guest today holds a BA in history and a PhD in education. She is a practitioner of something called dynamic facilitation, which is a way that groups can come together, come together and have an honest dialogue, understand each other's point of view, and try and reach some mutually agreeable conclusion as of some path forward. So that's really interesting. Her book will come out in late March 30th. And mm-hmm. There she is. Her name is Dr. Ruth Backstrom. Welcome to the show, Ruth. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So I gave that long-winded explanation of where, tell me, did I get anything right about the state of American politics?
Oh, I think you did.
What's the prescription?
So the title of my book is Igniting a Bold New Democracy. So I think democracy and climate change, we have to address them both. And what I'm suggesting is that we actually need more democracy. We need to bring citizens together in citizens' councils or citizens' assemblies. And fortunately, this has already started in all sorts of parts of the world. But I just want to back up for a minute before we get into the climate and say, we really need to put these two together, because if we lose our democracy, we will have a much more difficult time doing the things that need to be done. And I make a point in my book that there's three particular points that I just want to talk about before we go into climate. One is we absolutely have to reduce the levels of inequality in our country. We cannot sustain our democracy until we do that. And there's a lot of research that shows that. There's a study out of Washington University, Washington State University, with 14 other universities that says throughout history, if you get too much inequality, you're destined for revolution. So this isn't just a left-wing talking point. This is a serious consideration that we absolutely have to address. And so I really make that point very strongly. The other thing, we have to get money out of politics. And we've talked about this forever, and I know it seems impossible, but Maine has done a great job of actually trying to do that. At one point, they had 80% of their people in their state legislature were funded by state funds. So what I want is to talk about ideas to bring these really new ideas to life, to move us out of this gridlock. And I know that sounds really difficult, but it's a really important thing. And it's not as, I don't think it's as hard as we think once we get a certain kind of momentum. And I want to start with, then I want to get to climate change. Because there's
Let me just say, I completely agree that without a functioning democracy, there's nothing, you know, climate change is a secondary. Addressing climate change will never happen in an autocracy, right? So we need a democracy to do it. But there's a lot of good things about democracy of and by itself that are not necessarily climate related and I think that further your point about income inequality and I would say environmental justice are fundamental things. I mean, there's this terrible, you can't have a functioning, I mean, I listened to a podcast about ancient Rome. I don't know if you have Mike Duncan's podcast about ancient Rome.
Yeah.
But basically, and then about the French Revolution. It's like the patricians in Rome fought for 400 years to maintain their wealth, and they finally lost it because they would not let the Vandals become Romans, right? And the French, it's like you reach a point where there's so much power concentrated, it forces some kind of explosion, which is a terrible
thing.
Exactly.
That's exactly what they say. Yes.
And so, I mean, just in terms of keeping a peaceful society, these are not crazy radical talking points to talk about income inequality. But they're. I mean, I guess I'm interested – I would like to talk about climate. I mean, I certainly want to talk about climate stuff, but can you do that? Can you discuss direct dynamic facilitation in that context? Would you like, because I'd like to hear what the technique is. If you can explain it in a climate context, great. But I mean, any context is good. Whatever works for you.
In Austria, they just did a climate citizen assembly. So that's another thing that I want to talk about is citizen assemblies. That's really popular.
Well, tell me more about that, because when I hear Citizens Assembly, again, dear listener, you may not follow it as close as I do, but there's this organization called Extinction Rebellion.
Right.
And they're in England saying, you know, forget everything else. We want basically citizens councils to run the whole and make the decisions. It's kind of like a French Revolution, Paris Commune kind of idea, right? It's just I'm sure you're not talking about extinction rebellion.
Yeah, so it actually happened in Poland.
Go ahead.
Poland said they had a flood, and they said, okay, we're going to call a citizens' assembly together. And the way this works is they try and have it proportionate, so it actually represents the general population. And anything that 80% of the people agree on, we will have to enact. That was the agreement. So that's kind of the furthest, that's the furthest. I mean, in a lot of places, and dynamic facilitation is in Austria, and that only has an advisory role, but it's become so well established. It started in 2005, and by 2015, it was so well established, it's in their state constitution that they call a citizens council every year.
Really?
Yeah. So it's been so effective. I'll tell you a story about dynamic facilitation. And then I really want to go into these citizens' assemblies because they have been used all over the world now, especially around climate issues. And what you have to, but before I start that, actually, I'm going to back up and tell you about a study that was done in Stanford called America in One Room. And they brought 500 people together for a weekend in Dallas, Texas. And it was done at NORC, the National Opinion Research Center, had a proportional, so it looked just like America, it was proportionally like America. And they gave them a number of different topics to talk about. They polled them before they went in, and then they polled them afterwards. And one of the questions they asked is, what do you think of the state of democracy? And they said, you know, there was only 30% of them thought that it was in good shape. And then they went through these facilitated conversations, and they had experts. I mean, this is pretty much the formula that a lot of these things use. There's experts in the room from both sides that give you opinions on these things. And then you have facilitated conversations, moderated conversations, a better way to describe it, really. But they were moderated by graduate students. So I'm not sure how much they did except make sure that nobody was fighting and stuff. But at the end of that weekend, I mean, we're just talking about a weekend, they gave the poll again. And it went from 30% saying how they felt that democracy was doing well to 60%. I mean, that's a really interesting number when you think about it. It shows the power of coming together and talking and listening to each other. It's really easy to demonize the other side when it's an abstraction, you know, but when you're actually there, and people could change their minds. That's the other thing they found, is everyone moved closer to the center on these issues, you know. And so that was a really interesting thing, is that people could change their minds. There's a kind of group dynamic that takes over, and people are more open to taking in new information in these group situations.
So, I mean, there must be modern psychological insight about how people interact with each other. Because you're right. I mean, the ability to talk with each other in a reasoned way, I mean, that's what you're taught in kindergarten, right? Is to listen and be kind, right? What happens? I mean, is there any ideas why we lose that, and how it is that the 500 people? So again, what you're saying is there were 500 people brought into a room that, you know, magically represent America, and they, right, in talking with each other, found more and more common ground, just because it was not, you know, MSNBC versus Fox kind of, you know, strident,
yes,
stuff.
Yes, that's right.
Right?
That's right.
And that makes sense. And I guess what I'm trying to get at is whether or not, is there a new insight, or is this is, you could probably find that in Aristotle, right?
If you, yeah, you know, could, although there is a new understanding about our collaborative capacity, that we think of, like, an individual can work in their zone, right? And they're just really doing the best. They're sort of their peak level of performance. And now there's this idea that there's something called collective intelligence, which is what happens when groups are working in their zone. And Tom Attlee has done a lot of work on this. Just as dynamic facilitation was invented by Jim Roth, and he discovered that he could get people into a state where they were pulling out, you know, they were working really effectively. And the qualities of those states are that people listen to each other. They're not judgmental. There's a kind of acceptance of all the ideas that come into the room, and even delving into what's underneath those. Sometimes we have to figure out what's underneath the expression that's being made. And I guess I could give you a story to illustrate that. So there was a dynamic facilitation meeting in Austria, in a state in Austria, and they were looking at immigration, and they were asking, what should we do about immigration? And they were going along, and somebody said, you know, we have to see the people underneath the numbers. And that's, like, stirred up everyone's compassion. And then people kind of sunk to a deeper level in their discussion. And then somebody said, well, I don't think these immigrants should be given, they talked about finding them jobs. And somebody said, I don't think they should get jobs. I mean, I don't think they deserve jobs. And under certain circumstances, you can see they'd get, you know, in trouble for making that remark. But the facilitator said, well, why do you think that? And then he explained that he had a niece that had been working for 2 years to find a job, and she couldn't. And I think that's true in our country too. There's a feeling of, I've been so neglected that I don't have any space or generosity for other people. And so, in a way, we have to create more generosity towards everyone, towards the neglected people in our own country and incoming immigrants.
Well, it's an interesting point you make, because I think that I'm sure you're familiar with the question of college debt forgiveness, right?
In which
half the people say, well, it's unfair that I was saddled with this debt, sold this debt by the corporation, blah, blah, blah. And now I should be relieved of this debt. But someone else could say it's unfair that someone else gets away, gets to sort of dodge the price, pay the price for what they. So there's two definitions of fairness floating around, both of which are heartfelt, right? And until you go to the next level down and understand what everyone means by that, you're not going to get anywhere. You're just like talking past each other.
That's right. Although I like to bring up the GI Bill. That's actually the first chapter in my book. I talk about the GI Bill, where we sent 7.8 million people, vets, to school for free. And the payoff for that, for every dollar we invested, was $7 in return. And this was a huge sociological experiment that had not been done before. The head of the University of Chicago said, we're going to make hobo jungles out of our colleges. And they did it, but they had this great civic group of Republicans who really pushed it through and created this idea that it was a right for the GIs. And so we're the country that did this, that invested in people on a scale not seen before. And we have to go back to that legacy and start investing in people again. It's insane to have our future leaders crippled by debt when they're having to deal with a wobbly democracy and planet on life support. It makes no sense. And it's going in the opposite direction of any of the other industrialized countries.
Yes. Well, it's like, oh, yes. I wanted to go back, though, to a question we touched on before. If I understand you correctly, you're saying that in a properly facilitated group discussion, there is a new thing emerges, right? A new thing in the room called the collective intelligence, which is better than any of the individual actors, right? Collective intelligence. And this is sort of a half a question, half a statement. I would say this is not kind of a wisdom of crowds kind of thing where, everyone goes to Las Vegas and bets on who the president, whether the economy is going to go up or down, right? That's not what you're saying is that that there's this other thing that happens when people are honestly trying to learn about the other side's issues without passing judgment, right? Is that the secret sauce of the facilitate, the dynamic facilitation?
Yeah, and also, so everyone feels heard and safe. You're in a safe space. And as you go on, there's different charts where you're capturing information. And there's one chart that holds the concerns. So if somebody brings up a concern, then you take that and bring it into your awareness too. So you kind of lose your attachment to your individual perspective and start thinking like a group. Okay, well, we have to take this person's idea into account and this person's. And so maybe we should, so you start, it's really an interesting thing that human beings are like really prone to problem solving. They like to get into that state of problem solving. And when they get into a collective, they can sort of get into the space where they're just humming and they're taking all these different perspectives together, and they come together in a sense of feeling, a sense of solidarity in the end. And that's what happens with dynamic facilitation meetings. Is at the end of that meeting, so this guy, to finish that story, this guy said this about his niece not getting jobs. And he said, all right, well, let's open it up to everyone so she could have access to this too. And that was a great way to resolve these kind of differences. And so that's what they did. They then went on. So in Austria, they've got this sort of systematized. And what they do is you first have a dynamic facilitation session for a weekend to cover a particular topic. In this case, it was immigration.
And let me ask you, so just a question. Is the topic of a facilitation, a dynamic facilitation session, is it like a resolution, resolved, we will solve the problem of immigration, say in Austria? Or is it a more ambiguous kind of, how sharply defined is the discussion?
Yeah. In fact, it can change as you get to deeper levels. Like, what's the real question here as opposed and I think the thing that really came out was this idea that you really have to see their humanity. And they said, we should do everything we can to help them. And the interesting thing was, no politician could have the cover to say that. And that's the thing that these civic groups can do, is they can give cover to politicians to do the right thing, because the citizens have said that they want it.
So let me ask a different question.
Sure.
So we're talking about civic groups in Austria tapping into their collective intelligence to solve problems, right?
Right.
So now I say, I want to transport that to Boston, right? And we're going to go down to Faneuil Hall. We're going to have a meeting, right? Mm-hmm. How do you get everyone, or is it necessary that everyone be committed to a process when they go into the process?
It's a very loose process, actually. It's just a conversation. People love it because it's just a conversation and everyone is listened to and their ideas are mapped on the chart. But it's like a journey. You know, have you ever had a conversation with an old friend where you're kind of, you just start here and then you keep going and it gets deeper and deeper and deeper? That's what it's like, really, because everybody's adding to the conversation and they're getting to this deep kind of shared humanity. And what's the basic question here?
But sorry, go ahead.
So then what you do after this group meets, you go and take the people who are in the group, go and present their findings to a larger group, like 50 people. So you're spreading what happened in that group to these larger groups. And then they can comment and add on it, you know, flesh it out. I think that, you know, they fleshed out, well, what are these employment cafes that we're going to create going to look like, you know? And so all around this, I think this was a statewide one. So all around the state, they had this employment cafe set up where people, immigrants could come and other people could come to hear about different employment opportunities.
So I guess what I'm trying to work towards, and maybe you've thought through and we could talk about this. Let me translate the dynamic facilitation collective intelligence idea to Massachusetts, where
okay.
my fair state,
right.
the,
right.
is there, and there are issues. Okay. So there are various, energy infrastructures that are being proposed and bitterly fought over, between local groups and the government, not between different groups. I'm trying to understand where you would begin if you wanted to build a structure where citizens, collectives, I forget what the word, the citizens.
Yeah, so what they did is they started in rural places.
Okay.
Where they had small communities that knew mm-hmm. each other and where they actually had somebody who would do something with the results. Because, I mean, we talk a lot, but if we don't do something with the results, it's really discouraging.
Right.
Although it's interesting, I had a conversation with Manfred, who's the administrator who oversaw all this and made sure that the results were listened to. And he said the most important learning, this was really interesting for me to hear, the most important learning was in the group, which really surprised me. I mean, I think, though, at the end of the day, you do want results on a political level. But there is one of the chapters in my book talks about we need to have a learning society. Especially now, we're in this time of so much transition. There's been so much confusion spread about the climate. People are all over the map, don't really understand it. And we need to create an opportunity for people to learn. And that's what these, so I want to switch now to citizens' assemblies, which might be easier for you to wrap your head about.
Right? Yeah.
Because those have been around climate change specifically, and then usually a part of it, because it's such a huge piece. In fact, what somebody suggested, just to give you a vision, what we should do is have a number of different citizen assemblies where we actually have them taking different pieces of the climate issue and then come back together and kind of put together a plan, you know, that addresses all of those things for the state. Or what they're doing in England and other places is they're actually doing it for the whole country. They just finished in England doing a climate climate assemblies, basically, where they went throughout the country getting everybody's advice about climate, asking them questions.
But that was more than listening sessions, famous listening sessions, right? These were actual intensive conversations among committed people to talk about things, right? Yeah, okay.
Right. But it's very similar. I mean, it's like, so in the one in Poland, there are 56 people. The demographics, you know, were reflected. Gdansk is the name of the town that they had just flooded, and they were asking, how are we going to deal with this flood? And so these 56 people had 19 recommendations in the end, and 16 were chosen by 80%. So that forced the mayor, I think, of that area to implement those. And the next time they had a flood, they were even better prepared for it. Now, and this is this to me is the gold standard, is that somebody implements this stuff if it makes sense. Now, in Austria, it's only advisory. And maybe you have to start there, because there's a lot of learning that goes on, not only within the group, but within the administration. But the thing is, people basically trust what a group of citizens say more than what the politicians say, understandably, because they don't have anything in the game. They don't have any, you know, they don't have special interests.
How did the people get selected to be on the 56 people? Right? Was it
similar to what they did in America in one room, where they, you know, they did a demographic. They looked at the demographics and they tried to represent the, you know.
I suppose that's very important, that the makeup of the committee have credibility with the people who are going to accept the results.
That's right. And that's why they did it that way. I don't think that's really necessary, because in dynamic facilitation, they just had randomly selected people, although they did do some sorting, I think, in mm-hmm. Austria just to satisfy the people. But I think there is a phenomenon here that's going on that is bigger than this issue. You know, it takes us to our shared humanity in a way that makes the demographics not so important. You know? That's a hard sell, I realize. But I think I don't have to sell it. We could do these citizen assemblies, and I'd be perfectly happy. You know,
I guess. One question I have, because my gears are turning. All right, there. I live in a small town. There are certainly issues that are being addressed that are sort of climate related. Right. So Massachusetts has different kinds of requirements, for example, that say if you have a train station in your town, then you must build affordable housing near that train station and encourage high density growth. It's going to cut carbon pollution, but it's also an equity issue. Right.
That's great.
Well, it's
hard
great.
To get affordable housing in this time.
it's great, except that and it's not. I mean, it would be ripe for people to get upset about, right? Because they don't want something, right? So, is that the scale? Is that kind of thing the scale of a question that would be good for a citizens' committee, as opposed to somebody trying to like stop nuclear disarmament or something, right? Start small. Right, with a credible group and trying to accept those results, right?
Right, and then you could have these world cafes where they could explain it, and you could spread the feeling to, you know, what are the concerns that they have? I mean, some of it is addressing what are those concerns and how can we find a way to satisfy, you know, most of the concerns and stuff. Yeah, that's a great example. And the vision that I have actually in my book is that, what if we created a whole civic agenda this way? You know, like Massachusetts has been working on an economic bill of rights, which was one of the things FDR wanted, actually. I think the Rainbow Party or one of the more progressive parties. And FDR wanted it, but he died before he could put it into place. But what if they worked on something like that, and then Rhode Island is working on homelessness, and we just took each of us took a piece of these problems and created an agenda of what we'd like to see happen. That's my radical vision in igniting a whole new democracy.
I mean, what I just bouncing ideas back and forth, it seems to me like being on. So let's imagine you have a system in your favorite town where there will be these citizens assemblies, but it's almost like jury duty, right? You get a notice in the mail saying you're going to spend a weekend, you're going to get paid for it, maybe, right? Whatever.
They did. In some places, they gave them $500 for it because it was a lot of time.
Yeah. And you have and you have a civic responsibility to go and participate in this thing in good faith as a way of trying to resolve. And I guess, you know, shooting at my own idea, I think that, I mean, I doubt that in one weekend, even very smart people can amass enough information to make decisions about urban planning for the next 50 years, right? So it has to be very...
Although it's really amazing how quickly they can learn this stuff and listen to experts and take it in, you know?
Interesting stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's a thing. Like, so one of the things they found, this is another example of a DF thing. So there was this area in town where they were trying to figure out what to do with these train tracks. There was this beautiful water setting, and then there was train tracks. And there've been years with all these developers trying to figure out what to do with it. And they called a wisdom council together. And they said, you know, what we want is like Spanish steps that go over, you know, over the train tracks, so we could stand up and see the water in the distance and then walk down to it on these steps. I mean, it was a beautiful image. And they stayed a little late even to design it and stuff. And this was like, these people, these developers had spent years and never come up with anything as nice as this. I mean, the wisdom of groups is really profound when you get groups really humming, you know. And let me add a story. Oh, one more story, too.
No, please.
There's a woman named Judith Glaser who wrote a book called Conversational Intelligence. And she she was really interested in this idea. She didn't use the word collective intelligence, but she was interested in how you get organizations to work really effectively. And so she used some of the same principles. Like, she found if she could get people open to new ideas and really listening to each other, she could change like the whole culture of an organization. And she did it over and over again. And their sales would start to skyrocket because they were listening to each other and asking questions that they didn't have answers for. And so that's a really real life situation where she applied it, and you saw these incredible results in terms of the in terms of their bottom line, the money and stuff that they were able to prove and stuff.
Is it, so let me ask the question this way. Is it, I think in your book, you are at the sort of civic saving democracy level, trying to imagine new tools, right?
That's right.
And so those tools, almost by definition, are outside of the existing, I don't know, governmental processes. Right. This is a new thing in the world. Right. This is a citizens council. It's a different way of having a democracy. I'm putting words in your mouth. You tell me where I go wrong. Right.
Yeah. We think that. But I think, you know, Benjamin Franklin, he used to go around and go, you know, we need a library. Let's start a library. I mean, I think this is essentially quintessentially American. The idea that citizens are engaged. I mean, that's one of the things that Tocqueville talked about, you know, in his studies, is like when he came to America, he said, Americans are just, they've got democracy in all their systems, even the way they play and the way they think and their schools. And that was kind of the idea. Of course, John Dewey wanted that in the schools. You know, we need to have, you know, a democratic sensibility built in the school. So I think this is as old as apple pie.
but it's also runs parallel. It has to be parallel to existing I guess the case, what I'm saying is that you want to invent new tools in order to have a functioning democracy. When you say the existing tools are not giving us they're not resolving the questions that we have at hand, right? They're not effectively dealing with many of, certainly at the national level. So that, I guess that raises a whole other issue of the sort of the national level where maybe most of the dysfunction is versus local levels where there are issues, but maybe not as polarized because people are forced to see each other in the supermarket every day, right?
So yeah, that's right. That's
but
right.
I mean, and that opens up a whole other raft of like digital democracy. I've heard about digital democracy where there's sort of discussions of ideas that are online and there's voting up and voting down. You're proposing this very, in the age of COVID, a very face-to-face kind of discussion, right? We can...
Actually, they have got DF on... There's a program for putting it online, too.
Really? Okay. Yeah. So you... But you're talking about that sort of person-to-person contact about real issues and feeling safe in a discussion context to find out what everyone's thinking and get to a mutually better solution, right? And that's a new process in a democratic society.
Well, it's new to us because we've become very systematized and we've gotten very bureaucratic and big I think when we were smaller, this kind of thing was, you know, happened in a more informal way. That's what I was trying to say about it. You know, it happened.
That's interesting. It's an interesting point. I think Massachusetts and New England, to some extent, but very much in Massachusetts, there's a tradition of town meeting, where once a year everyone goes into one room and they sort out what they're going to do this year. And that is, in some level, akin to the kinds of things you're talking about. Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, all these conversations that happen on the golf course are the real, you know, the term.
I was trying to imagine a facilitation, dynamic facilitation in a climate context, as we were talking, coming up with the idea that the sort of, it's not ambiguous, but the sort of question you would want to discuss is climate change real? And I think, as you said, people learn, right? At the end of the weekend, people have learned. So you go and if people are in good faith, you say, okay, why do you think it's not real? And then we have a discussion and everyone comes out ahead of the game, right?
Right. In fact, this takes me to a citizens assembly in Minnesota where they had rural people come together. And some of the comments they made, somebody said, you know, they didn't realize how climate change was going to affect them so personally. That was one of the things that they took away. And somebody else said, you know, you could change your mind with the right information. Because a lot of people are stuck in these silos of information, and they've never really entertained some of the right information. But in a neutral kind of climate where you're getting, you know, all sort of a range of views, you can have people change their mind. That's the interesting thing.
In your experience, is that siloing... a silo, but I mean sort of a resistance to new information, I think is what you're saying, that you, is that a symptom of not knowing very much or not knowing too much, or knowing too much? I mean, do smart people get siloed because they're so educated, they think they know everything versus people who don't know anything?
Siloed,
and,
right?
I mean, which side?
We're all living in these bubbles. You know, that's one of the things that really hit me when I was writing this book, is I started to look at, well, what are the issues that Democrats have? What are the issues that Republicans have? And we make better decisions together, because the more diversity that you have in a room, the better, because then you can really problem solve effectively. I mean, one of the big points I make in my book is that our diversity is not a liability. It's our greatest asset. We're just not using it like we should. We're not listening respectfully and really hearing the needs. Sometimes it's really important to hear the needs underneath what's going on. You know, what is the need that's there? In fact, there's a guy, Marshall Rosenberg, who started this thing called nonviolent communication. And he found that if he could bring warring tribes together and get them to express what their need was, he could stop the wars. You know, if they could get to a place where they could hear and then decide to change. And it was just, it's really important, that idea of what is the need that's being expressed in that state. You know, it's awfully much deeper than what's on the surface.
I mean, I think it, not knowing much about psychology, but it's like people are driven to do things and they don't recognize their own deeper needs. And somehow when you say it, all of a sudden the air goes out of the balloon and say, okay, well, wait a minute. Now we understand this is either better or worse than you thought, but at least it's not this hidden driver for people's actions that they may not fully understand.
Right, right. I mean, there's all these things I think that get in the way, like the sort of tribalism of, well, I have to think this way because this is the way my tribe works.
Right.
And what if we extended our tribe to, like, we're all citizens in this together, instead of, you know, we have to have another identity. Where it's really, I mean, one of the things I talk about is, how do we change the national discourse so that civil discourse is preferred, that we stop taking the bait, you know, we stop always responding to every situation.
So that begs the question, what is it that people should, of course, read your book? Right, but what can they do? How can they? If someone agrees that, man, that's the dynamic facilitation, that's the cat's meow. I want to go do that. I want to figure out more about that. What should they do?
They could certainly contact me, ruthbackstrom.com, and I would, you know, get a team of people together to go do it. Mm-hmm. And they also could They could also go to groups like Braver Angels, is just having conversations. That's an organization that's working on this. And they bring people, they have chapters in every state.
And if someone, I mean, I think everyone is frustrated with sort of what appears to be this lack of civility and ability to get anything done. How would you, as a person, citizen in a town somewhere or a city or wherever you are, how would you recognize that there's an issue that would be best served by dynamic facilitation or this kind of approach? What kind of problem would present itself that you say, yeah, that's a good one?
The affordable housing one that you gave was a good one, actually. Uh-huh. Unless I think the complexity of that may be a little strong. I mean, the thing about it drops down to just recognizing your shared humanity. So the immigration one is, we just have to see them as people and serve their needs. You know, that was a little simpler than, well, how do we, I mean, but the complicated thing about affordable housing is, how do we serve multiple needs? And so that's the question that you have to get down to. What are your needs? Like, what's the needs of people who are already well established there? Are their property values? I mean, those are the kind of issues. Are the property values going to go down? How do we handle that? And those kind of issues you get down to. So it's not necessarily the nitty gritty of the details as much as saying, this is what we stand for. Right. This is what we think. So I think there should be a way to handle both these needs, and here's one way to do it.
Super. So tell me again, the name of the book, tell us again, the name of the book you've written.
Igniting a Bold New Democracy.
Igniting a Bold New Democracy, okay. And the subtitle is, I'm sorry, I cut you off.
Through game-changing reforms. So what I'm suggesting is we pick out the most important reforms and go for them, like getting money out of politics, inequality, climate change, the things that, you know, climate change, if we don't address climate change, everything else is toast.
Right. Yeah, I'm with you on that. As you say, the book is March 30th. I'll put up a link. Will it be on Amazon?
Yeah, they can go to my website and they can, you know, ask for updates on the launch, and I'll send them updates on when it's released.
And that's RuthBackstrom.com.
RuthBackstrom.com.
Yeah. Super. All right. Well, what we'll do is we'll put up links on the MCAN, the blog, the webpage that'll be associated with the show. And that will be at, that's going to be at massclimateaction.org. And you go across and look at the top, it says newsletter and more. And then you pull that down, it says blog and podcast. And then three or four clicks in, you'll find the hot links to this show, under which we will put these, the links to your website. Right.
Okay.
And, I always say, if you have questions, dear listener, or suggestions or things we should be talking about, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we ought to be talking about. You can listen to the show. You're probably listening to the show on your smartphone using one of the modern podcast distribution apps. Please ask all of your friends to listen to us on their favorite modern podcast distribution app. That's your climate action for the week, is to get other people to listen to these shows. I want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. It keeps us informed from week to week. And we want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investments, community councils, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. So, Dr. Ruth Backstrom, thank you so much for joining us and talking. It's been very interesting.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. And I wanted to suggest one last thing.
Please do.
You could do something like in Massachusetts. Washington did a citizens assembly. So you could copy what they did, actually. I think that would be great for you to do, and because you have these connections across the state, so it would be perfect for you.
That's great. Well, again, thank you for being here, and thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for having me.
Very cool.